compromise. Straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, what we're going to do today is sort of continue our trend of discussion of the last couple of weeks with a little more recent emphasis of what's going on the past week, which tends to confirm what we've been talking about. Well, what we've been talking about mostly about central banks and how central banks are feeding the stock bubbles and other financial asset bubbles that are growing everywhere globally. We can see them most obviously in the U.S. with the stock market continuing and accelerating its march. Stock markets, you know, the NASDAQ, the Dow, S&P 500, and so forth. And we can now see the same surge, record surges going on in financial markets in Japan and in Europe. And it's all because of the free money that is and has been since 2008 pushed into the economy by these central banks. And the free money, in other words, banks and other financial institutions can borrow this money virtually cost-free, although in the U.S. the price has risen minimally, but a little bit. And as I've said before, don't expect the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the U.S., to significantly increase interest rates. It's not going to happen. In my just-released book here a couple months ago, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, one of the main arguments that I make is that the central bank, the Fed, cannot raise interest rates significantly more. They've raised them to a dollar and 1.25% here from virtually nothing, 0.1%. But they're reaching their limit. Maybe one, maybe two more. That's it. The benchmark rate, the federal funds rate, can't rise more than 2% without precipitating a financial credit crunch, and therefore bringing all these markets down very fast, which has a major psychological effect on the real economy, and will bring that down in turn. That's the way the relationship works between financial cycles and real economy now in the 21st century. So don't expect much change here. All this talk about Trump reappointing somebody to the Federal Reserve chair in February, Janet Yellen, almost certainly will leave. That's not going to make any real change in the direction of the Federal Reserve and this free money policy, virtually free money policy. And by the way, the U.S. in its raising its token rates here is really sort of the odd man out, as we'll talk about these other central banks now very clearly in the past week have indicated their efforts to retreat from the free money are even more token than the U.S. The U.S. has announced, the Fed has announced it will sell off its balance sheet. In other words, that's all. The balance sheet is the Fed debt, Federal Reserve Bank debt, that is accumulated over the years, since 2008, by buying up all the bad assets of investors, their losses, subsidizing them, in other words, buying their bad bonds, and taking it off of the banks and investors, individual investors' balance sheets, their own personal balance sheets, taking it off at above market price and putting it on the Federal Reserve. In other words, bailing them out. Wouldn't it be nice if the federal government, for all those millions of people whose homes were underwater, if the Fed would simply buy up their bad financial investment that's less than market value and make them whole again? Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Well, they only do it for bankers, you see, and rich investors. You know, it's not just bankers, it's rich investors, because the Fed has been buying up bonds from, you know, wealthy investors as well as now they're selling it off, but they're selling it off so slowly and so tokenly because they're afraid the sell-off will raise interest rates, you see. So it's all about a token sell-off, and that's not fooling the markets, you know. It's not fooling the markets, financial markets in the U.S. and the investors. They say, oh, the Fed's really not going to do much significantly here, so we can just continue getting free money and push up the stock markets and so forth. And that's what continues. And now with the announcement this past week in Europe, European Central Bank, even more token. Not fooling anybody. And the Bank of Japan isn't even trying to be token. They're just continuing the gusher, the free money gusher. We'll talk about that. Although we have another shift occurring in China with the People's Bank of China, their central bank, and we'll talk about that shortly as well, which may be going now in the other direction now that the party conference, Communist Party conference, is over. So tokenism in the U.S., even more tokenism in Europe, and no tokenism in terms of cutting off the free supply of money, the money gusher. Because the financial economy globally is controlling economic policy decisions more and more, and they don't want to change because they're addicted to the free money, you see. It's been too long, too much, too long, and they can't get off it or don't want to get off of it. Right? That's the problem here. It becomes a political problem, you know, as I said on this show. Who's running U.S. economic policy? Well, it's Goldman Sachs. You know, it's the big bankers who are on all the key positions in the U.S. economy, government. And, of course, Trump himself is a big financial wheeler-dealer, you see. It just happens to be that it's real estate that is the object, but he's what we would call a shadow banker, right? Financial wheeler dealer. So, and all the people in his administration, not only in official positions, but all his friends that come into the White House unannounced, you know, their big hedge fund, private equity, and all those players. You don't see it, but those are the people who are running the show in the U.S. Anyway, okay, so let's, we're going to talk today more about financial fragility, instability, and the bubbles, which is a topic we've been dealing with the last two shows, because it's getting worse, you see, because it is beginning to froth. What you see in these financial markets, higher and higher, becoming more and more obvious that a major correction is going to occur probably next year. This is typical of the end of the cycle, end of this financial cycle, business cycle. The real business cycle has gone on weekly in the U.S. for about 8 years now, which is one of the longest ever. So it's prime. It's prime for a recession. But the financial cycle, which drives these precipitous reverses in the real economy, I believe. I cover that in my previous book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy. By the way, reviews of both are available on my blog and website, jackrasmus.com. And there are more forthcoming as well. Several people are writing reviews, further reviews. It's getting some attention from financial writers and others. But in any event, you know, this frothing is an indication, you know, it's evidence that it's topping out and it can't go much further. I mean, when you see really speculative markets like cryptocurrencies, with bitcoins at $6,000, rising from $1,000 to $6,000 per coin in 6 months, you know that's a bubble. Wow, if there ever was a bubble, that's it, right? But the stock bubbles are more sustained, maybe not escalating as fast, but sustained as well, and being driven by what's called momentum investing and trend investing, rather than real reasons to justify these price increases. Well, you know, you could say the big tech companies have just released their profits this past week, and they were significant. Well, that's a real basis for their rising prices. Yes, except a lot of it's being driven by sales into China and emerging markets. And now if China shifts to a slower growth on purpose, which it announced it will be doing this past week, if it shifts, slower growth, that means longer-term profits for the tech industry is going to take a hit here, and thus their stock prices will as well. Right? Okay, so today we want to talk about the global economy direction. What's going to happen if China purposely shifts to slower growth, and why is it now shifting to slower growth? Announced post Communist Party conference. You know, they did everything, pulled out all the plugs the previous year here to boost their economy, keep it going as hot as they can up to the conference, the party conference, where Xi, has been anointed. Well, now that that conference is over, now the announcement is, okay, we're going to slow down the growth. Why are they slowing it down now? Well, they're slowing it down because every time they pump up the growth, it means that they're pumping more liquidity, more money. The Central Bank of China is pumping more money into the economy and increasing debt in that economy, which is feeding not just the real economy, but is feeding debt and feeding financial speculation and financial markets in those in the Chinese economy. And what speculative markets are being fed in China? Well, historically, it's been housing, housing construction, and housing debt and local government debt. China's history since 2010 is on and off stimulus, fiscal stimulus, to get growth going, and that feeds the financialization of that economy and the growth of financial bubbles and shadow bankers that drive those bubbles in China. And then China turns around and says, well, we got to do something about this financial speculation and these bubbles, and they attack the bubbles, they slow the money, free money growth, slows the regular economy, the real economy, attacks the bubbles, and then they shift again and say, oh, the real economy has slowed too much, we have to pull back from attacking the speculators and the bubbles by slowing the economy. We got to boost the economy again with some mini stimulus, fiscal stimulus, and they do that. And when they are ignoring the financial speculators and the shadow bankers in order to grow the real economy, well, the bubbles come back again. And the whole history of China economy since 2010 has been this on-again, off-again, this rotating financial bubbles and trying to stop them by slowing the economy and others pulling back on the free money, which slows the real economy, not just the bubbles and the speculators, and then shifting again back to the real economy to get the growth going, which allows the bubbles and speculators to come back. And it's been this seesaw thing going back and forth in China ever since 2010. And in the process, Chinese debt escalates. And we'll talk more about the level of Chinese debt here, which is a big problem, potentially here. But, you know, the point is China has announced it's going to slow its economic growth. Now, the surge in economic growth in the U.S. In the last year since Trump is partly because China's been boosting investment, real investment in the global economy. China has fueled a bit of a recovery, not just in China, but also in Europe and in the U.S. But if that comes to an end, and China goes in the reverse direction, slows its economy, that will, with a lag, have an effect on the U.S. and European economies as well. Okay, so what does all this portend in China and the shift back to do something about the speculators and the bubbles for the global economy? That's going to occur. Okay, so let's continue here. We want to look at the U.S. economy here a little bit before we get back to central banks. All right, what's happening in the U.S.? Okay, well, if you look at the U.S. economy here, they just released third quarter GDP numbers. And what are those? Well, the third quarter GDP is 3%, 3% growth, following a 3.1% growth in the second quarter. Well, that's pretty good, 3% growth. Well, there's some problems with that. Let's look a little deeper. First of all, it's mostly inventory accumulation, a form of investment, inventories. Other real investment is not that great over this six-month period. And it's been a long-term downtrend, slowing real investment in the U.S. economy. Big problem. That's why productivity is not growing. Okay, so what's investment? Defined by the government, it's buildings, structures, equipment, capital equipment, transport equipment, machinery, you know, PCs, all that kind of stuff, software, and also inventories. So inventories have been growing here. An anticipation by business that consumption will rise. You see, the Trump trade, right? The Trump trade. They've been building inventories because they believe that they're going to be able to start raising prices and return profitability. But if you look at other forms of investment in the U.S., only 3.9%. And that compares with other forms of investment, you know, the machinery, equipment, and building structures, so forth, historically of 10%. So it's less than half. It's only inventory buildup. And in fact, home construction is down 6%. The 1% rise in interest rates already having an impact on home or housing construction. Right? So investment, business investment in general, is not in good shape. But it's this surge in inventories, accumulating inventories and expectations they'll be able to sell it, that is behind this 3% growth. Well, what about consumption? Well, consumption's like household consumption, 70% of the economy. Well, that's sort of growing a little bit, but if you look at it, why is it growing even a little bit? One, it's because households are digging into savings. They're barely saving anything again. And that's a sign of a late cycle as well. Right. And they're financing consumption with debt. Savings drawdown and debt spending, debt-driven spending, which is not sustainable. You see, what you need for good consumption is rising households' wage incomes. And that's not occurring. There's some spending at the high end of households, wealthier households, which reflects the wealth effect, it's called, which is spending based on rising home prices and stock prices and so forth. But that's the top 10% of the 130 million households, you see. So it's debt-driven, it's high-end, stock wealth effect-driven, and it's savings reduction driven. The savings rate in the U.S. now is barely a little over 3%, compared with 6.5% just a couple years ago, and an average that used to be like 8 to 10% in the U.S. So households are not in great shape, and you know, the spending is going chugging along barely. Looks pretty anemic, even though it's still positive. But that's also a sign of a late cycle, you see. Government spending, particularly state and local government, non-defense, down. Down. Historically, robust economy is usually associated with robust government spending, but that's negative. Housing construction is negative. Consumption driven by weak forces, and inventory, business spending, and inventory driven, which can't be sustained because once you get inventories built up and they're not being rolled off, well, then business cuts back on production, you see, and lays people off. Right. Some of the household consumption, debt-driven consumption, is attributable here in the third quarter to auto discounts. Auto companies are getting desperate to roll this stuff off of their lots because of exhaustion of that particular market. You can't keep selling 17 million cars and even trucks into the U.S. economy every year. It's the end of that cycle. Right? But they're trying to keep it going by discounts, you see. And durables, durable replacements in certain places because of the hurricanes. You know, that's behind the third quarter here. Services have only increased in the third quarter 1.5%, and services are 80% of the economy. So the real economy is still growing around 1.5%, barely, which is well below its historic average. And consumption will probably slow even more in 2018 because now health insurance premiums are doubling, partly because of problems in the ACA program originally, but also because of stuff that Trump has announced and he's going to do, which is driving up the cost of premiums once more, which is what they want to do. You know, they want to sabotage the ACA by making it unaffordable, and then they'll come back and repeal it. Anyway, you know, looking down the road with the current report, GDP report, and looking under the covers with that report, right, does not make that report as robust as it appears at 3%. Plus, I would add there's another problem here, and that is with U.S. statistics. It's pretty clear over the last decade here now that the U.S. statistics don't pick up seasonality very well anymore. We keep getting these winter quarters, fourth quarter, first quarter, at virtually nothing, no growth or very minimal growth, or sometimes even negative growth in a quarter in the winter. And then we get extra growth in the summer, right? They're not adjusting it properly. Something's happened, changed in the economy. So we're getting summer economic growth larger than it normally is, and we're getting winter economic growth lower than it is. But if you, you know, average it out, economy's still growing 1 to 1.5%. Not very much. Not very much. But if you look at the financial markets in the U.S., they're ballooning, aren't they? They're going through the roof. Oh, why is that? Well, it's the free money, folks, and it's the massive amount of money that's been accumulated because of decades of central bank liquidity injections that has been accumulated sitting on the sidelines everywhere, in the hands of wealthy people, of course. But it's out there. And that's what's driving these markets. And the real economy is not getting the investment. Productivity is, you know, for the last 5 years, there's less than 1% growth in the U.S. And not much really changing that. And if you got productivity growth so low, you're not going to get any wage increases, you see. And that's exactly what's happening, too. And we don't get any wage growth-driven consumption. So households have to turn to borrowing or digging into their savings. And that's what's going on. It's not a healthy long-term economic condition for the U.S. economy. Okay, so let's go back to China. You know, if the U.S. Growth here is very tenuous and not built on a real foundation and will soon almost certainly fall back here in the winter quarters once again, if that's the case in the U.S., and if because of that, I would add that the Federal Reserve knows that, and there's a big debate going on in the Federal Reserve, and they're not going to raise rates very much as a result, you see. And the financial markets know this, and they know the free money that's going to continue, and they continue borrowing it, and as a result, you know, they continue feeding and fueling the financial asset markets, the stock and bond markets, you know, and that will continue, the currency markets, right? The derivatives, which we don't even see, we don't even know that, you see, but that's occurring as well. Okay, let's shift to China. And as I said earlier, the fundamental point is that China has announced its going to shift its growth. Instead of pulling out all the plugs, including Central Bank, People's Bank of China, Money Gusher. And by the way, China only started behaving in this way, like other central banks, global central banks, after 2008. You know, the global crisis 2008 and 2009 saw all of the other advanced economies collapse, and their financial assets collapse, and their real economies followed in deep, deep recession. China was the exception. What China did was to engage in a massive government stimulus and investment program in 2008-9. Massive. While the world economy and trade and exports almost collapsed everywhere, and, of course, Chinese exports suffered. What China did was have its government fuel massive real investment and expansion, infrastructure, and so forth. Big program, right? But its central bank started pumping in money on a massive scale as well to fuel, finance that. Well, that's okay if you're pumping liquidity from your central bank into the economy and it's going into real investment. Right. And it was initially in China, went into real investment. But after the economy grew significantly, you know, very short downturn in China in 2008-9, and then a big growth, double-digit growth after that because of the real investment going on, driven by the government infrastructure, the economy by 2011, the government kept the central bank pumping massive amounts of liquidity into the economy as well. This is all covered in my recent book, Central Bank is at the End of the Rope, the Chapter 9, China Chases Its Shadows. It's really a history, each of these chapters in the book. You know, I look at China's central banking, U.S. Fed from 1913 on, policies, Bank of China, Japan, European Central Bank, Bank of England are all covered in great detail there, particularly since 2000. But the chapter on China looks at China's from the early 1990s and the 2000s and up to the very present. Right? And there's this big change, this shift after 2009 in which China has this big stimulus and then it opens up its economy and allows shadow banking to grow significantly, and it keeps pumping money into the economy while it continues fiscal policies and engages thereafter in this tit-for-tat struggle with financial speculators and shadow bankers and global bankers on and off again, as I described here. Many fiscal stimuli followed by attempts to corral the speculators, and that affects the real economy because they're cutting back on money injection. And then they reverse again and open the spigot on the money to get the growth going again, vice versa, right? That whole thing is really from 2011 on, that change in the economy. And it still goes on today. And this past year, as I said earlier, they opened the spigot and engaged in fiscal stimulus, which boosted the global economy, right? But it also gave a green light to speculators who began to run with it again. And now, after the party conference, China's going to shift again in the other direction. We're going to slow growth, which is an indicator that they're going to go after the speculators and the shadow bankers, right? And in fact, the party conference was barely over when the PBOC, People's Bank of China chair, Zhu, issued a public warning and said, quote, "If we are too optimistic when things go smoothly, tensions build up, which could lead to a sharp correction." That was a shot across the bow, you see, and a signal that they're going to try to contain these financial speculators and bubbles again, which grew over the past year, right? And even President Xi, his statements did not commit to continuing a 7% growth rate until 2020 and after. It was that reference, which always occurs in his statements, was missing in his speech to the party conference, which really is a signal also in combination with Zhu's warning that, okay, we're going to, even if it slows the economy a little bit, we're going to go after the speculators and the bubbles again, right? This is the rotating policies, fiscal monetary policies in China. Well, in the U.S. and Europe, Japan, there's been no rotation, you see. It's been monetary policy only since 2008. And we've talked about that before, how that policy is, feed the financial investors and the markets and so forth with free money massively, and hope that some of it trickles down into real investment in the real economy. That's been central bank, i.e. banker-driven economic policy, because the bankers indirectly still run the central banks, I argue in my book, and explain how. Okay, so in the U.S. and Europe and other capitalist countries, traditional capitalist countries, it's been monetary policy only and no fiscal policy. In fact, the no fiscal policy translates into fiscal austerity, right? We're going to enrich people at the top and hope it trickles down. We're not going to pump money into middle America and consumers and median households and so forth with fiscal stimulus. We're not going to do that and hope that some of it trickles up to the bankers and the investors. No, it's going to be the other way around. That's a major shift in global capitalism in the 21st century as well. Before, they used to balance both fiscal and monetary policy, but now it's monetary policy first and foremost. The exception to this is China. You know, where China will still use fiscal and monetary policy, sometimes emphasizing one more than the other, to keep its growth going. And, of course, its growth is doing much better. When PBOC Chairman Zhu says if we are too optimistic when things go smoothly, right, things going smoothly, growth is growing, tensions build. Well, what does he mean by tensions? Well, he means financial market tensions, which could lead to a sharp correction, in other words, in financial markets. That statement embodies what's called sometimes in economics a Minsky moment. M-I-N-S-K-Y, after the economist Hyman Minsky in the 1980s and 90s, who really took Keynesian analysis into the financial markets and expanded it. Great contribution to Keynesian economics, not the stuff that purports to be Keynesian, which really isn't mainstream economics. It's not Keynesian, but Minsky was, and what Minsky said was that within capitalist economies, there is endemically, intrinsically, a growth towards financial excess and financial instability, and that growth and foundation for an eruption, a financial eruption, occurs and grows when times are good. So it's apparent that times are good, but within it, you got this financial instability, fragility, as he called it, that continues to grow and it erupts. And when it erupts, of course, the real economy then goes into a retreat, a significant recession. Well, that's the Minsky moment, you know, the sharp correction, the tensions, financial tensions build. And the tensions are based upon the relationship between debt and income, according to Minsky, both in the primarily in the financial sector. Well, this is a Minsky moment. In other words, it's a statement that says, oh, too much financial speculation going on, right? And Zhu is saying, don't be too optimistic about good times because the tensions are building, right? And we could have a sharp correction, right? So, you know, the Minsky thesis was financial instability is endemic to capitalist systems, and it grows beneath the surface when times appear good. And the longer the growth period, the worse these conditions mature. It's debt-driven, leverage-driven, financial investment. And where does the financial investment come from? Well, ultimately, it comes from the central banks, you see. In my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I build upon Minsky's thesis here. And expand upon it, I think. And if you want to read my analysis of that, it's in chapter 14 or 15 of that book, where I critique the positives and negatives of Minsky in analysis, and then offer my own post-Minsky, post-Keynesian analysis in the final chapter called The Theory of Systemic Fragility. Reviews of that are also on my blog and website, jackrasmus.com. You might find interest because it's still relevant. And in that book as well, as in my central bank book just released, I do go country economy by country economy, including, you know, China and Europe and Japan and so forth. The two books are related. You know, the statement of why we have these growing financialization and financial instability and bubbles in the 21st century in particular. That's the analysis. But the fundamental cause of that is central banks since the 1970s and the collapse of the international monetary system, Bretton Woods, have been pumping more and more liquidity and money into the economy till we get to a point here in the 21st century where central banks are just a vehicle for subsidizing the financial economy. They create the foundation for this bubbles, because if Minsky analysis means debt, the accumulation of excess debt leads to these financial crises in part, then where does the debt come from? Well, it comes from largely from the central banks pumping all this money into the economy. But now we have, on top of that, we have other trends in the financial, technological trends in the financial sector, which are creating credit and bubble with, in addition to the money creation assistance by the central banks, you see. And a good example is cryptocurrencies. Right? I mean, people aren't borrowing money to invest in cryptocurrencies, and margin buying on stocks, which has always been a case, does not require central bank fiat money, doesn't require it. You can get credit based on money, and you can get credit based on values of your financial assets, you see. Brokers will allow you to buy stocks on margin. You don't put the money up, just the value of your previous purchases, if it's going up, allow you to borrow more money to invest more in stocks and drive them even further, you see. That was a main problem why we had a collapse of the stock market in 1929. But it was also a main problem in the bubble in China stocks in 2015, where the Chinese government encouraged investors to buy stocks and made it very, very easy to buy stocks on margin. Well, we had a bubble. It doubled. The stock market doubled within a year. And when it collapsed back down within a year, too. A lot of the problem was margin buying, right, which exacerbates the money injection. Okay, so that's interesting. We got these two statements, one by Xi and one by Zhu in China, which says, okay, we're going to take slower growth. There's going to be more financial re-regulation. And it's once again shifting back in the other direction. And it's interesting that they cite Minsky. But it's true. It's true. And we got these rotating bubbles in the last 6-7 years in China. You know, housing and local government financing, state-owned enterprise debt, right? And then in order to deal with that, the government tries to redirect the speculation into the stock market in 2014-15, which it did successfully, but created a bubble. And then the government pricked the bubble, and you had a collapse of the stock market. And where did all that liquidity money go? It went back into housing bubbles, creating a new bubble in what's called wealth management products, WIMPs, or it started flowing out of the country post the stock bubble collapse, right? Capital flight. And it's taken a year for the Chinese government to get control over that capital flight, which was significant initially, but they've figured ways of redirecting it. Well, now that they've got ways of keeping the capital flight from outflowing, and they're slowing the economy, we'll see whether those new means are able to prevent very wealthy billionaire Chinese and very wealthy, 1% in China, which is significant growth in the wealth of the 1% there, from sending the money abroad. By the way, some of the money did slip out, and a lot of it went into safety and real estate in Australia and in Canada and in the U.S., right? And that drove up high-end housing. In a lot of these places, right? But containing the bubble means slowing down GDP, right? Because containing the bubble means you're not going to push that much money into the economy as before in order to squeeze the speculation, but that also squeezes the real growth and requires a response with a mini fiscal stimulus eventually. We've been experiencing in China this latest mini fiscal stimulus in the past year. And trying to run up to the party conference, but now that's over. And now we're shifting in the other way. We're going to attack the bubbles and speculators, Zhu, right? Zhu's warning, and slower economic growth. Now, that slower economic growth is going to have global consequences because, as I said before, the economy globally growing here in the past year has been largely driven by China, stimulation, fiscal stimulation. Right. And the fact that the U.S. dollar has been kept low by the same Fed monetary policies. By keeping the dollar low, it subsidizes multinational corporations' offshore profits, you see, because if the dollar rises, then the value of these emerging market currencies collapse. And if that happens, the profitability of multinational corporations offshore. It takes a big currency exchange rate hit and reduces their profitability. You know, part of the profits, a good part of the profits of tech companies, U.S. tech companies just announced, is because the dollar has been low in the U.S. and therefore you haven't had this currency collapse in emerging markets that would negatively affect their profits, you see. It's a connected world, and currencies play a big role in profitability everywhere. China debt to GDP since 2008 has risen from 140% to 260%. In other words, it's a problem, and they're trying to get their hands on it, which is the flip side of, you know, let's do something about injecting so much money that's fueling the financial bubbles and fueling the shadow bankers, right? The target is to reduce it probably to 6%. Some say that China may be targeting about 5% growth, right? Well, that's certainly going to slow the global economy. There's no way you can get around that, right? And we'll see how much in 2018 that's going to occur, right? The growth in the U.S., is in expectations of the big tax cuts. You know, a minute ago I said the central banks were the big subsidizers of corporate profits and investor capital gains by providing this super free money. Well, you know, the subsidization is going to reduce to a little extent, to the extent that the Fed, the central bank, raises interest rates, right? It's going to cost a little bit more. It's not quite as free, even if the interest rate hikes have been token. Well, what they're doing here in the U.S. Congress and Trump is, we're not going to get so much free money. It's going to cost a little bit more. Well, let's offset that with big tax cuts for corporations and investors. You know, we're going to subsidize them through tax cuts. Right? The essence of neoliberalism, one of them, is this big emphasis on free money, monetary policy, free money, subsidizing investors, and big tax cuts been going on ever since Reagan. Tax cuts for capital gains and the wealthy, 1%. On the personal income tax and tax cuts for the wealthy corporations, in terms of the corporate income tax and tax rates. And we've talked about that. And we'll probably talk about it again next week because a further definition of the tax cuts in the U.S. will occur with the House passing its version of freebies for the rich. The point here is that subsidization goes on with fiscal and monetary policy in a quid pro quo, kind of a seesaw back and forth, right? Free money from the Fed reduces interest costs, and then tax cuts reduces fiscal costs to the wealthy, right? It's a big subsidization. The tax policy is subsidizing the rich. The central bank monetary policy is subsidizing the rich investors and the bankers, you see. And what's interesting is that the rate of subsidization is increasing. For some reason, they need to either offset the normal capitalist growth and wealth creation, which may be slowing down, or it simply may be that it's not slowing down that much. They just have found a way to accelerate it and multiply it, you know. I'm not convinced that there's a falling rate of profit in the industry, as some Marxist economists, Anglo-American-only particularly, seem to be enamored with the falling rate of profit thesis. In real economy, real production, I don't see any real evidence of that, because those capitalists producing real goods and services have been protecting their profit margin, expanding their profit margins at the expense of wages and other costs. You see, profit margins in those really real real investment, real economy have been growing nonetheless, you see. On top of that, they're accelerating the financial asset profits. So, you know, I think both are going on. We see these big changes in the labor markets and labor costs being reduced. You know, contingent labor, gig labor, part-time temp, all this. Eliminating benefit compensation and so forth, not raising the real minimum wage very much, reducing overtime pay. There's all these kind of changes going on in labor markets as well as financial markets. And the changes in the labor markets are subsidizing the profits of real business, real investment, while the financial changes and monetary changes are super subsidizing financial investment. Both are going on. You know, it's not either or, both. Okay. If we look at the U.S. economy, once again, the financial side, right, we have a Minsky moment underway, I believe, as well. Just as Zhu, chair of the Chinese Central Bank, warned in China, that's what's going on here as well. We see this frothing going on in financial markets, right? U.S. stock market keeps surging this week, right? Keeps rising and rising. We're at 23,000, you know, before a year or so, beginning of 2016, 18 months ago, whatever. Yeah, we're at 15,000, 16,000. It's like 7,000 on the Dow in just 1 year, a little over 1 year. Now, that's a bubble. That's a bubble. When prices on a sustained basis go that high, that's a bubble. And on top of that, we see the cryptocurrency bubble, which is even greater, right? The bitcoins and so forth. And that's going to continue, the cryptocurrency. Why? Because Japan has announced it's going to support cryptocurrencies, right? Everybody else is warning against them, even the big bankers, you know, like J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, and others saying, whoa, watch out, this is going to, this is a speculative bubble here. Even the bankers see that. Japan, which has always been the home of the big speculators since the 80s and 90s, desperate, is going to support it. So that's going to keep the cryptocurrency, Bitcoin and other bubbles going, right? There's over what's called the initial crypto offerings, coin offerings, ICOs, right? Companies after companies, speculators are creating cryptocurrencies, over a couple hundred of them created in the last year. We also see continuing problems in the junk bond and what's called the repurchase markets, repo markets. In the stock markets, what's driving the stock markets? Well, it's the profits of a few big companies driven by what's going on in the last year. Tech companies I mentioned, and also the relative still free money going on. But it's also driven by derivatization, I guess is the word, of what's going on in stock buying. Exchange-traded funds are an example of derivatives in stocks. Passive investing based on momentum and trends. In other words, the price is going up. I want to invest there because the price is going up, not because the company is doing well. Right. So we have this feeding frenzy going on in the stock market, and not just in the U.S. stock market, but in Europe and in Japan. Right? Markets aren't convinced that there's nothing more than a token sell-off of the balance sheets, that money will remain cheap. Whoever is going to replace Yellen, there will be no change. There never has been since Greenspan in monetary policy, right? Other central banks in Europe and Japan, which can sell dollars and buy dollars, are continuing. In fact, Japan's accelerating. Europe just announced, the European Central Bank, that it was going to, quote, reduce its QE, free money. Well, it didn't even want to call it a taper, just a downsize, you see. What Draghi, the central bank chairman, announced there they were going to reduce it from $60 billion to $30 billion a month. Ah, but it wasn't going to end in 2018. They're going to extend it out. So, you see, they play these games. Well, we're going to reduce the amount per month, but we keep it going longer. Well, that's a signal to the market that the free money is going to be here. Don't worry about it. If necessary, we'll boost it back up to 60, right? Right? So, and how much have these central banks pumped into the global economy? Well, officially, $15 trillion, just for the U.S., Europe, England, and Japan, $15 trillion. And they're worried about China's debt. And you add China, that's another $6 trillion. And then that's not counting all the reinvestment. That's just what's sitting now on the balance sheet. So it's about $25 trillion, as I point out in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope. And it's not stopping, you see. The free money. Capitalism is addicted to the free money. And the free money is producing super capital gains for them in these financial markets, and they're not going to kill that golden goose. But it creates a Minsky moment. At the same time, underneath the surface is growing, the debt is growing, and the conditions for instability are growing. And at some point, these markets cannot be sustained, these financial markets. And when they turn, it will be a shot heard around the world, and the financial markets are all connected, will fall like dominoes, and that will dry up credit for the real economy, which is already long in the tooth, in a weak recovery, and that too will then follow suit, you see. $25 trillion plus going on. Trillion. You know how much $1 trillion is? Well, if you had a stack of $500 bills, not end to end, but stacked them, $1 trillion would be 50 miles high. That's $1 trillion of $500 bills. Okay, just a little trivia there. The Bank of Japan is most aggressive. Hmm? By the way, you know, the buying of the bonds by the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan is not government bonds. It's significantly corporate bonds. Right? And the ECB, in its announcement, saying they were going to halve their purchase, indicated they're going to step up their purchase of corporate bonds. Well, they're subsidizing corporations, and they're subsidizing banks that sell bonds to corporations. So, you know, it's getting deeper, is what I'm saying. And in Japan, they're buying stocks. Not just corporate bonds and government bonds, but stocks and other financial securities. I mean, it's subsidization. Central banks subsidizing the capitalist system, you know, that apparently either can't grow on its own, or even if it's growing on its own, you know, let's make it even greater returns by financializing profits and providing that through the central banks. You see, that's the central theme of my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope. Something has changed globally in global capitalism. It's becoming more and more dependent on subsidization and financial asset profits than ever before. Right? Whether that's because non-financial profits are slowing is a debate that we can have with Anglo-American Marxists who think that's the case. I don't. I think both are going on at the same time. Okay. Okay, so the Bank of Japan, you know, they're not changing anything. And you see this stock bubble now in Japan, record, the topics, it's called the stock market, at a 10-year high, increased 200% since it started its QE program here a few years ago, right? And the Bank of Japan is going to continue QE. And what we get is billionaires more and more around the world, big record growth in billionaires. In Asia, billionaires increased by 23%. U.S. billionaires increased by 5% here in the last couple of years. And European billionaires also grew, right? But most of it is in China, right? What do we have? We have maybe 2,000 billionaires in the world now. 2,000 billionaires. Okay. Next week, we're going to talk about Trump tax cuts here, which will become more clear than ever before, of another form of subsidization of the wealthy and their corporations.